This is a lecture about Guernica. It won't pretend to give an account of the painting and its circumstances as a whole. A single lecture can't hope to do that, but rather to think of the mural primarily with questions of pictorial structure in mind. Questions of space in particular, of outside and inside, distance and proximity, grounding and groundlessness. These dimensions of Guernica demand our attention, I think, because in them and through them, Picasso worked his way towards a sense of the truth of what he was depicting. Space was the form truth took for him as a painter. My reasons for saying this I can't defend at length here. They make up the substance of the book on Picasso I'm writing. But in essence, the case is simple. Picasso discarded many of the tests of visual resemblance previous picturing had taken for granted. But this work of doubting and undoing left him with one ineluctable test. The truth of a depiction, its ability to present a certain aspect of the world in a way that would strike the viewer as apposite and faithful, productive of real knowledge of the thing seen or imagined, was its spatiality. If the nature of a scene's spatial character could be given form on canvas, and the distortions and omissions of particulars be seen to derive from or contribute to that character, then the depiction would have made its claim to be not just ingenious or persuasive or even beautiful, but to have told the truth. So much in general terms. But of course, to talk of Guernica is inevitably to broach the issue of Picasso's actual contact with, his living through, the events of the 20th century. My assumption is the one most of us go along with, that the century, in its tragedy, shaped and informed Picasso's worldview. But for the most part, it did so, I think, on a structural level. The epoch appeared in Picasso in the guise of a form of life, a shape of understanding, coming to an end. My phrase for all this in the wider field of Picasso's painting is the end of room space. The end of room space is what his art is about. By room space, I mean simply a feeling for and a confidence in a world defined by four walls, with laid out before us a nearby, familiar, manipulable world of instruments and bodies. In the background, maybe a window and a balcony. But here up front, where we are, a floor, a table, a guitar, a fireplace, wallpaper. This is the worldview, the notion of being and having that the 20th century shakes to the core. And this, of course, is also Guernica's subject. But now the shaking is treated epically, as the agony of a polis played out by monsters and heroes. I have to begin, therefore, by telling you a little about Guernica's occasion and surroundings, and I shall pare things to the bone here. Guernica is a painting in oil on canvas, measuring 139 inches by 307, 25.5 feet long, and more than 11.5 feet high. It was shown first in July 1937 in the entrance hall of the Spanish Republic's pavilion at the Paris World's Fair. This is a famous photograph by the architect Sert, taken at the time. Out past the steel pillars of the inner courtyard, you can just see Guernica in the background there, was a cinema under a flimsy ceiling showing films of the Civil War. Luis Buñuel was in charge. Guernica is a picture of an air raid. On the 26th of April, 1937, in the 10th month of the Spanish Civil War, the Basque capital had been attacked by a squadron of Luftwaffe bombers, supplemented by a handful of planes provided by Mussolini. The aim was to bomb and burn the city center in its entirety. It was the Luftwaffe's chance to see what the new incendiary explosives were capable of and to judge how long it would take to turn a town into an ash heap and what the effect of so doing would be on civilian morale. This last euphemism becomes the currency of cabinet rooms. In this sense, Guernica was inaugural. It ushered in the last century and our century's war of terror. Terror largely administered by the state, in which tens of millions would die. Unsurprisingly, Franco and the Luftwaffe took pains to conceal what had been done and by whom, though almost at once there were reliable and detailed reports from the scene. A propaganda war followed. The fascists spread the story that Guernica had been burned by Basque communists in retreat. Pillars of rectitude like T.S. Eliot inclined to believe them. Picasso made his first sketches toward a picture of the bombing on May Day in Paris, 5 days after the raid. 5 days after the raid. He appears to have begun work on the canvas itself about 10 days later. The first photograph that his companion Dora Maar took of the work in progress is dated 11th of May. We can be fairly sure from dated sketches done in conjunction with last-minute changes on the canvas that the painting reached its final form on the 4th of June or very soon after. From first sketch to finished painting, then, Picasso took just over 5 weeks. From the moment he began work on the full-size canvas, perhaps 26 days. The weeks were some of the worst of the century. Franco's forces moved north and east on a broad front, and the Republic began to devour its own entrails. From the 3rd to the 8th of May, in Barcelona, the Communist Party struck militarily against the supporters of PUM, the Independent Marxist Party, and CNT, the Anarchist Trade Union. 500 people died in house-to-house fighting. PUM was outlawed by the Republic on the 16th of June. The party's imprisoned leader, Andrés Nin, was murdered by Stalinist agents 5 days later. Largo Caballero was forced from the premiership. Naturally, Picasso's circle of friends was split by this moment of agony. Some, like Éluard and Aragon, shrugged off the Moscow trials, whose theatre of lies had poisoned the opening months of the year. Others, like Breton, who, ever the strolling player, came to pose with his wife, Jacqueline Lombard, in front of Guernica in progress. It's a negative. That's Breton, that's Jacqueline, and here's Picasso himself, sort of, you know, rather just visible. Others like Breton took the Moscow trials, rightly I think, for a new inquisition and would never forgive Picasso for his later groveling to the great leader. Dora Maar's politics were leftist and anti-Stalinist. One of her previous lovers, Boris Souvarine, lives in history as the first of Stalin's real, meaning nauseated, biographers. We know that Picasso was in contact with left-wing and anarchist friends in Catalonia. News reached him, almost certainly, of what had happened on the Barcelona streets. It sounds as though Georges Bataille was one main conduit. The great barn of a room in which, there's Picasso on the ladder at work, in which Guernica was stretched and painted, took up the top floor of a building in which, so Picasso seems to have believed, the action of Balzac's great story, Le chef-d'œuvre inconnu, took place. It was a resonance that Picasso treasured. It's actually probably not true, but anyway, he believed it, and yeah. But Dora Maar, who found the place for him, knew of it because it had been used as the meeting place for a group called Contre-Attaque, of which she had been a member, whose attack was the one to be countered is a question that preoccupied the group. Breton, as usual, was ready with an answer. He told Le Figaro, "Our aim is to maintain the revolutionary activity that had been betrayed by Moscow." Don't imagine that any of this familiar farce and tragedy of the left in the 20th century, was lost on Picasso as he brought his painting into being. But the dates I've given you put context in perspective. Guernica was planned and painted in the space of 5 weeks. It was an astounding feat of concentration. All its politics, all its response to fascism and communism and the new face of war was in the picture. Guernica, to state it again, is 25 and a half feet long and a little over 11 and a half feet wide. This is immensely bigger than any painting designed for a wall that Picasso had done previously. Only a couple of stage curtains, a special whimsical genre for which Picasso called in a team of assistants, came close. I think that from Picasso's point of view, the sheer height of the painting, it could be wedged just perhaps tilted slightly forward under the beams of the Contre-Attaque assembly room, but only just wedged. The sheer height of the painting may have been even more of a challenge to his established ways of looking than the panoramic width. Painters of murals are obliged to be pragmatic about the kind of sewing together of part and whole that is possible in a picture 25 feet long. Some viewers will find this pragmatism, the casual hierarchy of episodes in Guernica, unsatisfying. They always have. If I don't, this is because I think that Picasso so completely solved the problem that for him was primary, that of the painting's height and ground plane. 11 and a half feet is a true change of world for Picasso. It puts the top of the painting, the ceiling, the skyline, the felt ability of the depiction to contain space, even where it threatens to slide off into infinity. It puts all this out of reach. And this is dangerous, especially for Picasso. It puts room space in doubt. And I've already said that it's this kind of containment, this imagining of space as finite, and the making it fully there in the painted rectangle, that is basic to Picasso's sensibility. If a painting loses hold of its upper edge, if the top boundary of the picture is not every bit as present and determinant a fact of viewing as the line along the picture's floor, for him it loses hold of everything. Space has slipped through his grasp. And therefore, here's my core proposition, really, so does a set of felt equivalents for the things, the bodies, the agonies that the space contains. I think, as I say, that eventually Picasso solved the problem. He found ways to make the painting's height work for him. Guernica, to put my argument boldly, is a picture that makes its giant size, a giant being always essentially tall, with all of its other dimensions following from that, work to confirm a wholly earthbound and essentially modest view of life. Life, says the painting, is an ordinary, carnal, unnegotiable value. It is what humans and animals share. There is a time of life and a time of death. The two may be incommensurable, but humans, especially from the evidence of Paleolithic burials, it seems a species-defining trait. Humans structure their life imaginatively in relation to death. They try to live with death, to keep death present, like the ancestors whose bones they exhume and reinter. But certain kinds of death break that human contract. And this is one of them, says Guernica. Life shouldn't end in the way it does here. Some kinds of death, to put it another way, have nothing to do with the human as Picasso conceives it. They take no form as they take place. They come from nowhere. They don't even have the look of doom. They are a special obscenity, and that obscenity, it turns out, has been a central experience of the past 70 years. Death from the air, immediate. We know, actually, from all kinds of evidence that Picasso himself was absolutely terrified of death from the air. Absolutely obsessed by it, particularly in 1940, but always. This, then, in a nutshell, seems to me the measure of Guernica's achievement. It finds a way to propose this, the obscenity of the new death, pictorially. And what that way is will be my main subject. I'll proceed chronologically. We know that when Picasso was visited by the Republican delegates in early 1937, he told them that he didn't know whether he was capable of the sort of painting they wanted. For a while in the spring, he seems to have been in denial, half wishing the commission would go away. But when the subject of Guernica seized him, he knew, this is again my intuition, but surely a common sense one, that it came with political imperatives attached. Firstly, and most deeply, the bombing would have to be pictured as happening in public. It would have to be shown to distort and, in a sense, to isolate specific individuals, isolating them in the way that terror is meant to, but nonetheless to do so in a space that was somehow shared among a citizenry, held in common. Privacy had been torn apart. The room must give way to the street. And second, whatever terrible damage was done to the women and animals in the picture, and the damage would have to be great, they were not to be robbed of their ordinary materiality. The damage should confirm their creatureliness. However much the new time of death might disperse and madden them, they had to be present on the ground or in the window, actually falling and staring and screaming. These are noble imperatives, and Guernica's eventual ability to respond to them is, I believe, what gives it its continuing life. Of course, we know just how uncomfortable it remains for the powers that be, right? The extraordinary story of the Velcro covering of the tapestry at the UN and the run-up to the Iraq War resonates. Noble imperatives, but, and here again is the nub of my argument, these imperatives are profoundly difficult self-instructions for the painter of bread and fruit dish, the cubist. They lead him away from the space he naturally lives in. Public and political, so Picasso's first attempts at imagining the scene suggest. I show you a study done in pencil on gesso, dated May the 1st, must mean happening outside. But is the outside a space Picasso can truly think pictorially? Geneviève Laporte once asked, I've always lived inside myself. I never saw any. I always lived inside myself. Is then the outside a place Picasso can imagine, can people, fill with suffering creatures, that is, as opposed to whimsical players in a dreamscape? He tries again the following day, May the 2nd, using the same old master medium. He's trying to be serious, but the questions persist. I think the best way to come to an understanding of these strange first attempts is to look back for a moment to the 4 years immediately preceding Guernica, 1932 to 1936. They're a complex and in many ways unhappy time. They seem to have end for much of 1936 in some kind of crisis of confidence, or as much of a crisis of confidence as Picasso was ever capable of. He paints almost nothing for months on end. He engraves spasmodically. He pours his energies into a weird and, to my mind, pretty bad poetry. Guernica, among other things, is a convulsive awakening from this previous trance. I mean, it's actually so typical of Picasso, of course, that having painted more or less nothing for almost a year, the first painting he does, well, I'm not only going to do a painting again, but it's going to be the great painting of the century. You know, this is the typical Picasso weird wager. Well, but the previous unhappiness and loss of direction is real. And there are many facets to that unhappiness, but I seize on one that connects with my story. In the mid-1930s, Picasso began to make the outside world his own. Sometimes it was the open space of the Bullring, and sometimes, this is a wonderful theater curtain, actually, for a piece by Romain Rolland, sometimes a terrain vague of myth. The beasts are provided with a landscape setting, or at least the bare signs of one. They're down in the arena fulfilling their destiny or circling the walls of some kind of Troy. And all of this, I should declare my hand as a critic, is accompanied, I think, by a massive drop in aesthetic temperature. If what Picasso is trying for again here is a kind of classicism, then the new version only goes to confirm the true seriousness, the massive ambition of the classicism of the 1920s. This is the Pipes of Pan from 23, which had gone on fighting for an epic space made out of cubist materials. The fight is over in the 1930s. A token exterior has won. Of course, things are more complicated than this. Picasso is never dismissible. There are real achievements in these years, real imaginings of space even, but the question to ask, with Guernica in mind, is achievements of what kind? Here, then, is a painting I take to be one of the finest Picasso did at this moment, dated March 1936. It's in pen, watercolour, and a single strip of pasted newsprint across the middle. And it's small, just over 13 inches by 20, 13 inches by 20. Therefore, on one level, the comparison with Guernica is factitious, but it's telling, I think, still. Commentators on Guernica often make the point, sometimes disapprovingly, that the mural makes use of many of Picasso's stock properties, that it smells of the Bullring, that its women and bits of and pieces of warriors have migrated from the beach or studio. The point is obvious, and le crayon qui parle, that's the phrase on the strip of newspaper that seems to have sparked the whole invention here, le crayon qui parle confirms it. So many of the elements of Guernica are already there in Le Crayon qui parle. The resemblances are uncanny. A dark house to the right, with sun or fire glowing through its windows. A chopped off head of a man, a bearded man, a hero of some sort, on the ground, nestling in the grass. What appears to be a source of light in the sky may be held by a hand with long streaks of ink tracing their beams across the picture plane, and an agonized figure in the center, half human, but with the head of a horse or a monster, maybe crucified, maybe hung in a noose from a tree branch. The point is not just to enumerate the features the painting shares with Guernica. It's to suggest how ordinary these features became for a while in Picasso's art, and above all, in what kind of outside they existed. For Le Crayon qui parle is a landscape, and the landscape is essentially weightless. The light shines through its ruined structures. The main figure is ghostly. The tree mimes horror, the ladder leans whimsically against the wall. You see the ladder there. It is a space of fantasy, of free association, a surrealist lantern slide. So the question follows, if this is the kind of exterior that seems to go naturally, in Picasso's case, with fire and agony and dismemberment, then how on earth could those modes of experience be put back into the world, given weight, made ordinary and substantial? Isn't the outside for Picasso always going to be a dreamscape? The imperative to make pain public, it follows, if that is to mean situating it in an outside of sorts, is for Picasso deeply at war with the imperative to make pain incarnate. This is the problem that preoccupies him for the next 5 weeks. The making of Guernica turns, I think, on the devising of a space to contain the action that would not be this first fairy tale edge of the city. What in the end replaces it in the mural is hard to characterize, that's the point, for it cannot be room space exactly. I'm not going to tell you the story of an artist simply returning to the little world he knows and making his final masterpiece out of it. Certainly the space of Guernica has some of the character of a room. It is paved, apparently with tiles. It appears to open out left and right into an openness beyond itself, but at the two top corners there seem to be lines in perspective fixing a room's top edge and sides, even a few tentative beam lines up top. And Baldessari has suggested that as the painting proceeded under the rafters, and as Picasso digested the evidence of Dora Maar's tremendous photographs of it, I mean, he would have seen the photographs as he was proceeding, the oil painting interjected, as it were, certain features of its actual surroundings. It became more like the space it was made in. Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that's a very, very interesting suggestion. But I'd say yes and no. It may take on certain features of room space, but I don't think this means, particularly at actual size, when the top of the picture is almost out of reach visually, that the space ends up looking contained and intimate. It's not a space into which the outside comes as light does through a window, in the way of the great still lifes of the 1920s. The outside is there, all right, but as inruption, instantaneity, horror, somehow or other, the outside has to be made present in the picture as a proximity that is absolutely foreign to us, absolutely non-human. This is a huge reversal of the cubist intuition. No wonder it was such a struggle. I'll leap forward. The 9 days following May the 2nd seem to have been mainly devoted to first ideas for particular actors in the drama, the horse above all, and the desperate mother clutching her eviscerated child. The question of space is secondary for a while. It's the nature of pain that matters. Then, on the 9th of May, Picasso makes a first attempt at a version of the whole thing, using roughly the dimensions of the mural to come. The sheet teems with ideas, but spatially it hasn't come far from the pencil and gesso studies done a week before. The bull stands in front of a shattered townscape, twin tiled roofs framing him left and right, the lamp bearer's house, there it is, see the lamp bearer and there's the house behind, is a doll's house miniature. Guernica burns in a kind of middle distance behind a deep foreground of corpses. It wasn't until 2 days later, 11th of May, that the first real breach with this edge of the city exterior occurred. And it happened, typically for Picasso, when the question of real scale was faced head on. The canvas was stretched, the attic was cleared, and work began. No more than a day or so later, Dorrit Marr took the first photo. It's stupendous, this first state of things. Clement Greenberg later went on record as thinking it much more successful so far as one can tell from photographs than any of the later stages it went through. He meant to provoke, as of course he often did, but you do see what he means. I look at state one of Guernica and immediately think of the wonderful pen and watercolor drawing by Ingres, self-portrait of the artist at work on his Romulus in Trinità dei Monti. There it is. It's very lightly colored. I just couldn't find a reproduction in color, but the color is on the ceiling. So a very little color in the picture itself. The comparison here operates at several levels. Both documents we're looking at, state one of Guernica and the wonderful Ingres, both documents exult in the actual visible enormity of the task called history painting. And both record the moment, the essential shamanistic moment in the history painting tradition as Frenchmen conceived it, at which, after the plotting and painstaking of the preliminary studies, the first linear form, pure linear form of the whole thing, appeared out of thin air in the vast empty rectangle. It's hugely important, I think, this decision of Picasso's to recapitulate the procedures of Ingres and Géricault. Above all, to go back to the moment of pure line, depthless line, at the beginning of things. Line, you will immediately see, by contrast with the sketch of 2 days previously, puts the image on the picture plane and all but collapses the middle ground, the crowded middle ground. The lamp bearer leans out of the window and comes straight past the window, the women underneath. The bull spreads out laterally and loses his shading. One figure from among the tangle of fallen warriors reaches up, maybe rigid in a last spasm, and lays out his chest, his torso, his penis, both his legs in strict parallel to the picture plane, right? This extraordinary figure here. Unique in Picasso's art, I think. It's as if the wild hindquarters, the wild hindquarters of the horse in the study have migrated to the hero. And just to be sure that one feels the pressure of the picture surface on these various forms, each moved closer and closer to it, the surface is traced out also as pure geometry, a crisscross of verticals and diagonals, sometimes extrapolated from the forms they approximate, sometimes seeming to suggest a further order of light or recession that as yet has nothing in the world to adhere to. Line like this recalls us to surface. That would be one way of putting it. Ingres' ability to go on discovering this and delighting in it is what makes him one of Picasso's main gods. But of course, the first photograph shows it. Line is also transparency. Space flows through it unobstructed. It cannot make space materialize as the heavy, close thing Picasso most deeply felt it to be. The further making of Guernica, to put it in a nutshell, was a sequence of attempts to solve this riddle. Could one have space finally registering on the surface, felt as a heavy, breathable, confining reality, without a picture of this size becoming all obstruction, all detail, all brilliant bits and pieces? This lecture, to say it again, cannot possibly do justice to its subject, There are, for instance, now known to be 9 photos taken by Mar of Guernica in progress, plus a close-up of the horse's head early on, and 1 or 2 shots of Picasso at work, with the painting shown obliquely or in part. I mean, you've seen 1 or 2 of them already. Any one of these states deserves more attention, I think, than it's so far been given in the literature. A full account of state 1, to return to it momentarily, would certainly have to go further with the angle comparison. This is Romulus as in its finished state, right, the angle Romulus. And that comparison, in turn, since Ang usually appears in Picasso when sexuality is in question, would lead to the uniqueness in Picasso's work of this moment of homoerotic male beauty. It seems to me strange that this uniqueness has not been recognized. The turn of the male hero's nakedness into the picture plane is charged, I would say naive, in its equation of resistance with phallic perfection of form. Again, the comparison with the drawing from 2 days earlier is telling. It's one of Guernica's signal achievements, I've said already, to have death acted out by women and animals without the action partaking, in my opinion, of the erotics of the bullring. Women just are the actors in Picasso's world, always. It may go on being a problem for us that what they perform most of the time is sex and death. Women, he said on one occasion, are machine à souffrir. We can take that aphorism as compassionate or gloating, according to our preference. It's part of a longer and deeper debate with Françoise Gillot about the actual state of the war of the sexes. But for our purposes, what matters is how it plays out in Guernica. I think compassion rules. And Picasso knows full well, I think, that in order for it to do so, he must defuse, throw into reverse gear, his normal association of violence with the sexual act. The way the mother with the dead baby is treated in the 9th of May study, there she is, right, the woman, here we are, right? Mother with the dead baby, look at her relation to the horse and the horse's hindquarters. That's typical of Picasso. Logically, the mother must be back in an undefined middle ground on the far side of the horse's splayed hindquarters. But visually, one part of us registers the horse's haunches as belonging to her. And this conflation of horse and woman, or the hands of another survivor to the left, right? Here, these hands. This woman's hands clutching. Here's the woman, head, breast, hands clutching the dead man. These are normal, this is sort of love-death, right? And conflation of animal and woman. These are Picasso's normal imaginings, so to speak. State 1 of the picture, 2 days later, seems to me a first attempt, as I say, a naive attempt, to expunge this normality by simply reversing the sexual signs. If the male hero could concentrate the erotic energy in his fist and chest, then maybe the woman in flames to the right could agonize without her agony being desirable. It's simple-minded, this, with all the simplicity of repression. But it goes to show the erotic stakes of the Guernica, and a full account of the picture's making would have to trace the way this first homoeroticism, this borrowing hole from Davidian theatre, was gradually worked out of the system. One great thing that had to go, of course, was the phallic clenched fist. It grew bigger. It gathered itself a phallic halo of sunlight and harvest festival. I mean, total energy and procreativity. And then it blew away. It blew away. Francis Freshina has argued that one main reason it vanished was the state of things in Barcelona at the very moment Picasso was working. The blood of anarchists in the streets and the triumph of the party. The clenched fist, remember, was more and more specifically a Stalinist symbol. Francis may well be right. And of course, as Arnheim long ago argued so eloquently, there are complex structural reasons why the picture couldn't go on hanging so decisively from a central unbroken spine. But part of the painting out of the fist, I'm suggesting, is best understood as a kind of embarrassment on Picasso's part. State one had been too beautiful, too male, too Greek. It was transparent about too much. Too male, too Greek. A further brief word on this. If we go back to state one of the picture again, and let our eyes move right from the central hero, it hardly needs saying that the women are for the most part still the hero's partners in a sexualized dance. They shriek like Glauke in her flaming coat, or sleep half naked like a fallen Amazon on a sarcophagus. I mean, the relation between this extraordinary figure here, right, the flaming figure here, and here's Glauke in the great Medea, one of the many Medea sarcophagi, of course, right in a poisoned, burning in a poisoned dress, Medea's witchcraft. Sex and death, then, in state one, are still intertwined. An immense effort of pictorial will would be needed if women's bodies in such a context were eventually to obey a different logic. Eventually, in my view, they did. And the new kind of drawing, staccato, cut out, stamped flat by panic, is again bound up with a new kind of space. Look at the lamp bearer and the woman in flames. Now, I wanted that to go to... Oh, yes, okay. Look at the lamp bearer and the woman in flames in state one. The woman in flames is still shrieking and dancing in a foreground marked off from houses in flames in the rear. As the picture proceeds, this foreground becomes all there is. The world the women belong to, the house from whose window the lamp bearer issues, for instance, presses against the picture plane so that the lamp bearer's breasts squashed flat against the picture plane. Here they are, right? Are a kind of synecdoche for the picture's spatiality as a whole. I'll say more about Guernica's version of closeness in a moment. Let me just point for now to the effect of closeness on the actor's flesh. Things here are complex. No doubt proximity and the arrival of strong black and white contrasts result in a freezing and flattening of form overall, a stamping of everything into hard silhouette. The actual drawing of the lamp bearer, for instance, hardly changes from state one to state ten, but her place in the pictorial action, her leap forward into too much visibility, is utterly different. She becomes seeing incarnate. Seeing reduces her to a sign. But that isn't the general rule. The stumbling woman, this woman right in the foreground here, compare state one, acquires a lurching, propulsive weight as she comes nearer, with knee and foot desperate to support a body off balance. Toes splay and swell. Even the hieroglyph of the falling woman to the right is given a steel-grey shading, seemingly at the last minute, so that her hands and neck are almost as strong a note in terms of stressed solidity as the neck and muzzle of the horse. the falling woman emblematizes the new style. She's swallowed by the compositional machine. But the swallowing comes across as truly grating and atrocious, as well as crazy and grotesque, because so much has been done to make the woman an isolated instance, wide awake and agonized, with a claim on life just as death happens. Everywhere in Gernika, the shards of the painting's light, dark architecture, its blast effect, slash through women's bodies. Look at the door through which, though never for me comprehensibly, the woman in the foreground is stumbling, right? This door and the shadow across it. Look at the triangular guillotine severing her knee, or the falling woman's preposterous toes. There they are, emerging at right from a kind of striped straitjacket. This is a language of pain and vulnerability that has, I think, left fantasy meaning fluency, behind. But maybe that's still too weak a formulation, for eros in the falling woman truly gives way to thanatos. Fantasy in Guernica is turned toward death. Of course, this is always an imaginative possibility. Death is deeply part of everyone's fantasy life, but only rarely is the figure of the last instant of staring at nothing as it happens to you allowed to walk on stage. I believe it does so here. So, the erotics of Guernica is one among several stories worth telling, and still, I think, largely to be told. But my story is space, and even here I have to be massively selective. There are, to repeat, 9 steps toward the picture's last appearance, and I'll leap to 2 moments quite close to the end. The earliest, state 6, is on top, and state 8 is below. By the time Picasso was working on the picture as we see it here, probably 2 weeks or more into the process, maybe right into the first days of June, the basic tonal and spatial structure of the thing had been long decided. The painting was going to be organized around a repeated pattern of polarized lights and darks, a triangulation, one might say. Look, for instance, this is clearer in the finished painting, at the grey and white geometry emanating from the lamp, or better, the deep black slashing across the doorframe underneath the lamp bearer, or the flames, the window, the strange ceiling line top right. Guernica's critics have always objected that this geometry is crude. Its triangles are academic. I'm sure they're right, but the answer to them, I think it's the answer Picasso was struggling for all through the last weeks, was to engineer a kind of heavy, palpable activity in and around the geometry, on the surface, in the nearness of the foreground, that would counterweigh the crispness of the armature. I think he did, as I've just been saying, apropos the picture's erotics, but I think it was hard. A lot depends on real size. Actually, you are getting about real size there. Guernica suffers hugely, it's the price of fame, from being continually miniaturized and disembodied in the world of mechanical reproduction. You should try to build into your judgment of what I now say about its spatiality an awareness, a memory, or imagining of what it's like to be in front of the picture itself. Remember that one's sense of physical location in regard to the scene, and I mean by this not one's measured height against it, but one's imaginative projection into its space, is that it is hugely bigger than oneself. That at most a viewer comes up to the horse's chest. We are, to borrow a phrase from Michel Leiris, on a level, terre à terre, with the giants here, looking up into a world that is flimsy and vulnerable. The pinned paper feel of the horse's body is notorious, but heavy, ordinary, standing on the same ground as ourselves. And of course, the artifact of the slide or the JPEG utterly travesties this physical relation. The best I can do, don't laugh too much, is offer a photograph like this of the elderly professor snapped by a student, which is already taken from quite far away, you notice, and in no sense is it creating a false proximity to wage war with the textbook's false distance. I think it registers at least the kind of seeing Guernica intends. I mean, of course, we were very, very lucky, actually, when we went to Madrid. We were let in on the closed day, and, you know, you can't usually get up quite that close to. But even from, you know, 20 feet away, it's immense and overwhelming. So what can I say about that seeing? Well, at least this. First, we are certainly back in a world of nearness, with everything pressed close to where we are. But this doesn't turn, in the end, on the making of an overall container for the action. It doesn't turn on the outside-inside distinction. It's sufficiently obvious that Picasso decided finally to offer us bits and pieces of both. The skyline up top changes constantly from ceiling to roofscape. This might be irritating, a sign of the painter's inappropriate cleverness, if it mattered. But in situated vision, it doesn't matter. The upper part of the picture is accompaniment. It's not where space is in Guernica. Space is here, lower down, closer to us, in the weighted, grounded, bottom-heavy world of the giants. Space is a matter of silhouettes and painted cutouts, constantly jockeying for attention with quite other kinds of extension in space. The horse's neck and jaws, for example, or even the slight, actually it's illusionistic, billow of the curtain as the lamp bearer pushes it aside. Or the push, the flow, almost as if she's squeezed from a tube of the lamp bearer's face towards somewhere right over our heads. It took some doing, this. Let me go back then to states 6 and 8. 6 on top, 8 below. Our best guess is that we're a week from the end. One thing that's always fascinated commentators about these two moments is that in them Picasso appears to have stuck pieces of patterned, presumably coloured wallpaper, onto the painting's blacks, whites and greys. It was more than a momentary whim. Both pieces of paper in state 6, can you see them? This one and this little one here. Both pieces of paper in state 6 are applied to the woman stumbling across the foreground from the doorway at right. One of them is a loose patch of wallpaper, and the other has been carefully cut to the shape of the woman's headscarf. There is a moment, seemingly a day or so, when the pieces disappear. There's state 7 below, and work goes on in other areas, notably work on the woman falling from the flaming house. Look at how immensely different she's become from 6 to 7. And then the pieces are stuck on again. Both of them just slightly differently placed, and two more pieces are added. A wallpaper strip pasted over the grieving mother's dress to the left, and a bizarre cutout, again of what looks like wallpaper, trimmed to the shape already barely comprehensible of the falling woman's lower region. We are back in the world of cubism here, which is one reason I choose this for a finish. And it's clear that the pinned-on papers, though in the end Picasso discarded them, were what provoked the most obviously cubist feature of the final work, the lines of black stippling here. that all at once in June spread over more and more of the horse's body, turning it partly into a newsprint image of itself. I interpret the moment of collage this way. Even so late in the day, with the ebb and flow of monochrome long established as the painting's matrix, Picasso looks to be uncertain about whether the light-dark geometry really made the picture happen on the surface, or happen enough on the surface, or whether it opened the illusion backward in perspective into too much space. It's the old problem for him. And the collage pieces are surface literalized. I don't believe Picasso ever seriously entertained the idea of changing the picture's whole pictorial economy at the 11th hour, or even of interjecting here and there a note of color into it. I think he was thinking about what in the picture kept surface present. Above all, about how much differentiation of surface texture, surface incident, was needed to interrupt, to flatten out the light-dark machine. In the end, he saw, commas of horsehair were enough. But this was because, in the meantime, he'd found a solution for the picture's most unresolved aspect, its ground level, the nature of the contact between its actors and objects and the surface they stood on. This is still radically underdetermined, you'll notice, in State 8. The broken shards of the warrior, right? I mean, the warrior has become a statue of a warrior broken in pieces. The hooves of the horse, the Bataille-esque big toes of the woman lurching in through the door, they all fall into the bottom edge of the picture like so many weightless, unlocated floaters. The change, when it comes, happens fast. Look at the interim state again. This is the ninth of Dora Maar's photographs, and a matter of hours before Picasso decides the painting is finished. And as soon as the surfaceness rediscovered in the collage pieces begins to be put into the painting, spreading out across the horse's back and belly, right, they're already spreading. The whole balance of space and ground in the foreground goes into the melting pot. The horse's hooves have legs to attach to. The broken statue becomes three-dimensional. Cut-out surface is answered by hard ground level. A grid of tiling springs up, anchoring the painting's whole spatiality. Look at what it does, for instance, to the long, hard-edged diagonal. This one, right? Like the bottom of a wall or even an upended door that pushes back into space behind the stumbling woman, the horse's forehoof, and the warrior's broken sword. That line, as a basic structuring idea, had been there for days, maybe weeks. It seems to arrive at the same time as the first painted, pasted papers. But it doesn't really operate on Guernica's foreground. It doesn't carve out sufficient space for the foreground actors to stand on until the grid of tiles is painted in. Then everything seems to harden and clarify. The curving grey shadow midway across the long wall. It's the shadow of the curtain hanging over the lamp bearer's forearm, I think, snaps into visibility. The horse kneels heavily on the tiles. I like the photo Maar took of Picasso squatting on the studio floor by his painting toward the end. And pondering, of course this is me reading in, right? Pondering just what would it take to materialize the still abstract last bottom inches of the illusion. In the end, the creatureliness came easily, almost naively. But only because he saw finally how surfaceness and groundedness could coexist. Forms spread out along the nearest possible front edge of the floor plane, as if no more than a few inches from us. Up above, bodies switch to and fro between paper thinness and stamping solidity, and the squares of tiling are pushed back beyond the bodies, making them seem closer still. This is proximity in a word, but reinvented, in its flatness finding its feet. I'm almost at the end. I said at the beginning that the book I'm writing about Picasso centres on the question of truth in painting as he conceived it. And here at the end, I should make that question explicit. We know from the merest glance at Picasso's achievement that a very great deal of what previously counted as tests of truth in the tradition he came out of has, to use my metaphor one last time, gone out the window. Lifelikeness and verisimilitude, those two strange coinages, are no longer the issue. That is to say, Picasso doesn't want to persuade us that the world he's created is continuous with ours exactly, or even equivalent to it. His isn't a world in which the enclosing envelope of space is transparent and continuous, and bodies occur as finite interruptions of it. His world doesn't teem with surface detail, and its actors do not address us, do not look back at us from a securely human situation. And yet, the idea of world in Picasso persists. And therefore, I argue, there is one thing that painting finds indispensable, namely space, the making of an imaginatively habitable three dimensions, one having a specific character, offering itself as a surrounding. This is the great Three Dances of 1925. For Picasso, in other words, imaginatively habitable equals forming an interior of some sort, taking shape as a felt proximity. One way of describing this constant in Picasso's art is to say that picturing for him is unthinkable if it doesn't aim at providing a space for being in, providing a room. And maybe even my adding a simple substantive to room here is wrong, because providing room, the sine qua non of the human, just is for Picasso providing a room, a specific and familiar floor, wall, wainscot, window. Being for human beings, and how deep is the pathos of that recursive noun, has at it, as its very precondition, being in, reaching out, really or imaginatively, and feeling the shape and pressure of a familiar place. I hope that saying this helps to bring the achievement of Guernica into focus. Suppose modernity were to come upon an instant in which the whole imaginative structure of habitation, of being in, of shaping the world around an implicit model of room and window, of containing and belonging, being inside or out, looked its death in the face. This is 1919, and of course, he doesn't have an inkling that the aeroplane in the sky is going to do what it... He should have had an inkling. It already had, actually, once or twice. But here's the hopeless optimism of modernism, right, before the catastrophe. Suppose this collapse of the imaginable habitation. Suppose this were more than a local atrocity just happening in one Basque city. Suppose that in the bombing of Guernica, modernity encountered its true future and saw a whole form of life collapsing, ceasing to exist as a determinate form of life. How on earth was painting to represent such an ending without falling itself into a spatial rubble, a spatial nothing, maybe propped up or distracted from, as by a conjurer's misdirection of attention by foreground melodrama? That was the problem. There will, I think, always be disagreement about whether Picasso found a solution. There are critics that go on finding Guernica intolerably melodramatic and spatially incoherent. That's who I've been arguing against. But what I want to suggest, above all, what I hope this lecture has made it possible to suggest, is what the task consisted of and how deeply it threatened every coordinate of Picasso's worldview. That I can even claim that he rose to the challenge, that he found a way, rather at the last moment, to put his humans and animals on a ground, and one that was neither outside nor in, but truly in a dimension where one was becoming the other, and one where women and beasts still fought for a footing just as everything dissolved. That I can claim this at all, this enormity, and hope to persuade you, is more than enough.